On this podcast, Stuart Clarkson reports on creative skill sets, somewhat controversial workplace survey, and what it tells us about the radio industry. You'll be particularly keen to meet the man who left Global Radio 4 years ago to work as a train driver. And I'll be visiting the folks who made all the new radio studios at New Broadcasting House.
The Radio Today programme, with Broadcast Bionics, creators of Phonebox and Oasis. Welcome to the Social Studio.
Thank you for downloading the weekly podcast from radiotoday.co.uk. As you can tell, I'm not in a studio, but I'm in a place where they make studios, or they put studios together. I'm at IPE Systems, which is in Melbourne, in rural Cambridgeshire, and you wouldn't expect to find what I can see here. It looks like something out of Dr. Strangelove. I've got Ray Bragg and Colin Judge with me. Colin, tell me what's going on here.
This is the pre-build of a newsroom facility for ITV.
So I would have expected to see some radio studios being put together in here. Today you're just working on television.
Yeah, our guys are on site at the moment down in BBC Plymouth, installing a station down or refreshing the studios down there. This is the next one that's going on, which is for Tyne Tees.
And give us an idea of some of the radio clients that you've had recently.
Our clients tend to be maybe BBC. We've rebuilt Radio 1, 6 Music, 5 Live, but also a lot of the local radio studios we've been working on as well.
So those, I think I could say now, famous Radio 1 studios were once upon a time in this room being put together.
Yeah, the ones up on the 8th floor of West 1 were built in here.
And what?
And the ones before at Yelding House we built here as well.
You built those as well, did you? That was your fault.
Yeah. Sorry.
Let's bring Ray in here. Ray, you were telling me earlier you were a studio manager at the BBC. What have been the big changes, not just for people operating them, but for people, you know, engineering studios?
I think the biggest change of all, and it goes across both TV and radio, is the use of computers. When I started out, I was editing quarter-inch tape in radio with my Chinagraph pencil and my razor blade. Now, everything's based on computers, and it's all about moving material and editing material on those. And the same goes for much of the equipment. It's now computer-based, and we no longer have rotary knobs and analog desks. It's all digital. It's changed quite a lot.
Is it a bit harder to make it work again, to repair it, when it has gone wrong? I mean, I'm thinking of motor cars, where you used to be able to tinker with them, and now you have to take them to the dealer and he gets a laptop out.
Yeah, I think if you're getting into the true engineering and something failing, then yes, it is harder to repair it. And you certainly need people with more IT skills than you ever needed before. However, one of the good things is they, as a general rule, tend to fail less often. So it's a bit of a balance between the two.
What's happened to the old skills we used to call engineering? These people I can see around me, they look like scientists.
Definitely the people who build all of this are still engineers and still sit there and work through. The great difference really is that the equipment used to be operated essentially by engineers in the past and were trained as such. Now, increasingly, equipment and the way things are put together are designed so that less skilled people, that doesn't mean they say they don't have any skills, but operators can operate it, and it doesn't need that level of engineering to actually make the system work.
One of the things that's changed in the last few years is there's a lot more syndication, there's a lot more working together, combinations of radio stations working not just down the line but across IP. That must be something that is a big challenge for you guys, Colin.
Yeah, the BBC are working on a project at the moment where they're starting to connect their local radio stations together over IP. It's a bylaw project.
And is commercial radio doing something similar?
Yeah.
How's that going to change the way that radio works?
I don't know that radio in its fundamentals is going to change that massively, but the way that it's engineered is increasingly going to be that the equipment's going to be kept all in a central area, all maintained in a central area, and a radio station will increasingly be somewhere where you have control surfaces for people to control things, but they're controlling things that are happening remotely. And that gives a lot of advantages, particularly to commercial operators, because it's less expensive to keep the system running.
I guess it also means that radio stations, which we used to think of as discrete entities, can be relay stations.
Or can be joined together in one form or another. You know, once you get digitised audio and put audio into computers, you can now push it out to a whole host of different places all at the same time.
Just come back, if we may, to this business of studios and when you go in them. So you don't design the studio or do the acoustics, but you must have noticed that studios look different now from how they used to. You know, gone are the big clunky heavy doors. In has come a lot of glass, which we were often told we shouldn't use because it's a reflective surface. How do they feel to you, Colin?
The main difference is light, really. It happened in the recording studios a while ago, but certainly in the radio studios. If you think of Radio 1 down in Yielding House, was down in the basement, a very dark place.
In every sense.
It's now up on the 8th floor, and it tends to be more visible to the people working in the environment around them. So if you take World Service or Global News at the BBC, they've built their studios into glass boxes, and they are surrounded by the newsroom or the journalists around them. So there is an interaction, a visual interaction between the studios when they're on air and actually the staff inside them.
And is that okay? I mean, do we not have problems? Because, I mean, I'm just thinking of Radio London, where if the music is too loud in one studio, you can hear it next door. I mean, that's not progress, is it? I don't know.
I think it's to a degree compromise. I think there's been a change from, perhaps, if I may put it this way, a bit of traditional BBC approach, where you were trying to get the perfect sound in the perfect environment, but perhaps didn't have very much interaction by about the people around you and the general feel of the place. I think we've become more accustomed to hearing a bit more acoustic around the person's voice and the rest. And maybe that makes it feel a bit more like home. Maybe it doesn't. I think probably your listeners will have to judge more than we can.
The other thing that you mentioned is visualisation. So put crudely, this is cameras in studios. There is a danger, isn't there, that radio broadcasters turn into television performers?
Well, yes. It's the technology is all converging. The audio, the visual, and the way we view it and listen to it is changing as well.
That's an interesting thought for you guys, because a radio studio and a television studio, are they becoming gradually the same thing?
I wouldn't necessarily say they're becoming the same thing, but they're at ends of a spectrum. So obviously the TV studio still tends to be predicated on pictures first and sound second. And in an ideal world with a visualisation studio, it's sound first and pictures second, although perhaps a few broadcasters aren't necessarily following.
We hear you.
The same way.
Okay, so here's something that interests me. We're in, as I said, in a village in a little town in Cambridgeshire. One would sort of imagine that this kind of work was happening in Japan. What's the background to you guys and why you're here?
My background is I used to work for Neve Electronics.
And we all remember Neve desks. They were very common in the BBC, weren't they?
Yeah, and that's the old Neve factory was about 400 yards from here. So I lived in this area.
I drove past on my way here.
Rupert Neve Close.
Rupert Neve Close, exactly.
Yeah, that's where it was.
Is that where it was?
It's now a housing estate, unfortunately.
Okay, and so is that why your company is here now?
It probably is, yes, because the company was set up in 1983 by John Chalmers, who at that stage was running the turnkey department of Neve, and he then decided to move out of Neve and set up on his own. I joined in 87, and there's always been a supply of resources around here.
Well, you were telling me earlier that you've got people here who used to work in the aerospace industry, yeah, which is not far from here, Stevenage, that area.
Yeah, a lot of the wiremen and technicians were trained up in the aerospace industry, Stevenage. So it gives them a really good background for what we do.
Now, why is there no radio on in here?
That's a good question, actually, because there normally is.
They haven't turned it off just because we're recording, surely.
No, not at all. It's normally playing, actually.
Okay, one other thing. How much work do you do with broadcasters when you're designing your systems? How often do you sit here with a DJ and say, does this work for you?
Probably we don't necessarily sit with the DJ, but we will be sitting with various levels of management within any of the broadcasters.
For management, right? What do they know about anything?
All right, engineers, if you want. You have to remember, management at the end of the day tend to pay for it, so there is a bit of a balance there. But there is a great deal of effort in trying to get the layout of technical desks and the way that the equipment relates to the people operating it. And certainly, from time to time, we will get operators, DJs coming down to have a look, to be able to see whether they can reach things. We know how important that is from an operational point of view. They've got to feel comfortable working it.
And you, as we said, were an SM. Can you work this stuff?
Just about, but it's got increasingly difficult as I've gone along, and very, very much slower, as Colin says. Yeah.
Okay, Colin Ray, thank you very much for having us here at IPE. Let's have some news. It's Stuart Clarkson again.
Thank you, Trevor. What a week it's been. In a minute, we'll look in detail at the findings of a survey of people working in radio, which looks at things like pay, contracts, training, diversity, and access to jobs in the industry. First, though, some of the other big stories this week. The Arqiva nominations are out. Global and Bauer dominate this year. 77 of the 100 places available on the shortlists go to the two big groups. Well done to all the nominees. We'll see you at the awards on the 8th of July. Lots of UK finalists this year as well in the New York Festival's World's Best Radio Programmes Awards. The Indie TBI Media picked up 10, seven of those together with Snapping Turtle and Radio 2 for the D-Day 70 Years On programme. There are 8 nominations for BFBS, 8 for BBC Local Radio, lots more as well. The full list is at radiotoday.co.uk. Some other news, a great fundraising effort from Bauer Stations this week with more than £500,000 raised for Cash for Kids. Greg James has written and stars in a new pilot of a BBC sitcom about a radio DJ. It's going to be on the iPlayer later in the year. Richard Bacon is back on BBC National Radio 8 months after leaving Five Live. He's doing a week of cover on Radio 2 Drive Time next week. Team Rock has been found in breach of the broadcast code by Ofcom this week. It's after it played a song with the F word in at 10 to 8 in the morning. There's a new production company for 606 on Five Live from next season. After 8 years of something else, Shooting Shark will take over making it. That's Simon Cross's indie. And the slow death of AM continues. In Berkshire, the original frequency used by Radio 210, 1431 kilohertz, has gone off air for good after the owner of the TX site wanted their land back. Global's also turned off the neighbouring Smooth Thames Valley transmitter for Newbury. The change means Absolute Radio is no longer on 1233 AM in the Reading area either. It's Rage Hour Week with the release of the Quarter 1 2015 figures. Full coverage, as usual, on radiotoday.co.uk. And we say farewell to a legend of the radio scene in the northwest of England, who leaves our industry this week after 40 years. She did 25 at Piccadilly and Key 103 before moving across Manchester, and she spent the last 15 years at Laser House on Salford Quays, the home to Century, XFM, Gold, Rock Radio, Smooth, Real, and probably some others that I've forgotten. She's known and loved by thousands of people in radio, so we salute you, Pat Broom, hashtag anti-Pat, a very deserving nominee for the Unsung Hero Award at this year's Arqivas. Lots of people are going to miss you. Congratulations on your 40 years service to our industry. Now to one of the stories that's got you talking most of all this week, the Creative Skillset Workforce Survey. They've questioned 5,000 people from across different creative industries in the UK. There's a report detailing the findings within the radio industry, and headlines include that average pay is apparently around £32,000 a year. Nearly half of us have done unpaid work at some point in our careers. And also just under a fifth of workers in radio are freelance, it says. We can get some thoughts on this now from the radio industry commentator Adam Bowie, who's a former head of strategy at Absolute Radio. Adam, one of the things in this is about access to the industry, the number of people doing work experience, for example. Do you think this survey is actually reflective of how things are in terms of getting into radio?
I suspect it is. I mean, 48% of the radio workforce got work experience, first of all, and that is probably the key way, in my experience anyway, of getting in. And it's a brilliant way of getting into radio, but it does have with it some limitations, because work experience by its nature is mostly unpaid, and that means that you need to be able to afford to live while you're doing that work experience.
And one of the figures in there is about non-traditional recruitment methods, and more than half of people working in radio came in via a kind of non-standard way of recruitment. Is that something we should be worried about?
Well, it's not surprising. Basically, if you get your foot in the door and you show yourself capable, and I think everyone in the radio industry knows people who, this is exactly how they've got their job. They've shown themselves, they've made themselves useful, they've helped out, they'll fill the photocopier, make the tea, do tech ops in the middle of the night at Christmas Day, they will help you out on your OBs, and then you do those things and you do end up, oh well, we've got a position coming up, you know, maybe that's the way in, rather than putting an ad out there somewhere. I mean, some jobs are advertised, but many aren't, because you kind of say, here's, we know this person can do the job, they're brilliant, they've shown themselves, they've proved themselves, that's how you get the job.
Yeah, and I suppose that also leads to, I know, a lot of younger people willing to work for less money coming into the industry, but this report suggesting actually it's quite an old industry, a lot more people over 35.
I think that's probably down to where you work. You know, some of the big groups, you do have older people. So the groups have been around for a while, then, you know, the age tends to spread out. Obviously, if you're paying smaller salaries, if you're a smaller operation, then maybe people move on a little bit quicker. So it's not terribly surprising. In fact, it would be unhealthy, I think, if the industry was not spread across the whole age range.
Something that's not mentioned in this report this week is about the numbers of black and ethnic minority background people working in radio. I know this organisation did some surveying on that a few years ago instead, so it's not included in this. I'm not entirely sure why, but is that an issue that we should still be thinking about?
I think it's a critical issue. I mean, I think that there's a section on diversity, and they talk about 35 plus as being diverse, and they talk about sexuality, and they talk about disability. And I mean, there's a note that, you know, radio is underrepresentative in the disabled category, and that's probably reflective of a lot of industries. BAME, or lack of, is really obvious. And when you sort of see people like Lenny Henry standing up, particularly in regard to television, you would think that, you know, the same has got to be the case in radio, with so much radio particularly based down in London, and London being particularly ethnically diverse. You know, that's a kind of critical measure. But I think as well that comes on to the whole kind of aspect that radio is probably very middle class too. I mean, I thought it was interesting that radio as a sector is twice as likely as average to have people coming from independent or public schools.
I mean, you're the stats man, Adam, and I know that at your time at Absolute, you did a lot of analysis of figures from across the industry. One of the figures in here that people are finding a little bit hard to believe, certainly in the Radio Today comments, is the one about salary, average salary, about £32,350 for people working in radio. Is that a figure that has any credibility?
Well, an average is always a very simple, you know, especially if it's a mean, is a very, you know, it's using a hammer to crack a nut, really. So what you're getting is you're getting some people who are probably on minimum wage or maybe just above it, and then you're getting a bunch of people, radio execs effectively, who are running some of these stations and are probably earning a decent living at it, some of them. It's, you know, so an average, you know, really doesn't tell you a great deal. There's probably a lot of people, as you say, who are looking at that saying, well, that doesn't seem to reflect what I earn in my wage packet. But then you've got to consider there will be some people, particularly in sales, and sometimes we forget that, who are probably earning decent money, especially in national sales. And you've definitely got the kinds of the owners, some of the PDs, some of the better paid jocks who are, you know, are pushing that average. And sometimes, you know, if someone's being paid incredibly well, that brings the whole average up. And so it can be, you know, thoroughly misleading. You know, actually, you need to see a range. You need to see, if you get into the statistics, things like variance or standard deviations that you can see, or even just simply quartiles, where you break it down into four and you can just see where you stand.
And do you think it's time for a bit more open discussion about pay in our industry? We mentioned work experience placements and how long long they can go on before they're considered as a job you should be being paid for. John Myers raised the issue about internships a few months ago, about people doing work that they weren't being paid for, that perhaps they should be being paid for. Is it time we were a bit more open with our colleagues and started talking about what we're paid and making sure that the boss is not ripping us off?
Well, I think it's actually something like this, which is probably the only really reliable measure of pay. And unfortunately, as I've said, it's quite limited in what you can get. I mean, as far as unpaid work goes, yeah, that is a problem. And there's, you know, John Myers has sort of raised it, and quite a few people have raised it. And what it's clear here is there's a lot of people doing a lot of unpaid work experience across the industry. And the problem with that is most of the work now, particularly as we've seen so much consolidation, and most of the radio jobs are in large metropolitan areas. London, Manchester, Salford are the kind of obvious ones. So if you don't happen to live in one of those places, or you don't have friends there, and you don't have some means of supporting yourself while you're working for a week, a month, 3 months, sometimes much longer even, then you're basically cut out. And that's reducing the talent pool available to radio enormously. It means effectively, in a lot of cases, you're being supported by mum and dad. And that means you're probably of a certain type of social class. The big problem is we end up with a workforce that is not very balanced and is heavily pushed towards a certain type of class of people, and they're making programs that are supposed to be aimed at everybody. If we don't reflect our audience in our own staff, our own workforces, then we're not going to reach the kind of people we need to reach.
Okay, thanks, Adam. That's Adam Bowie. Well, I think it's probably the survey's findings on pay that have probably got most of you commenting on our Facebook page and on the Radio Today website. Many think the £32,000 average is quite hard to believe, especially those in commercial radio. Here's just a few comments. This seems pretty punchy. My radio salary started at £13,000. When I earned 18, it was seen as a bit of a coup. Not even the news editor was near £32,000. From a former commercial radio PD, I left radio 18 months ago. In the months before I left, I was still being given £13,000 to find a full-time journalist. Someone else says, it is possible to achieve better pay, prospects and personal development in a local ASDA, which demonstrates what an outright joke the radio industry is in terms of pay and conditions. In many cases, the entire industry takes massive unfair advantage of people's passion to work at a radio station, and in return for that enthusiasm, they're rewarded with below par pay and terms. And I'll have a gig if they're paying £32,000. In the real world, however, you'd be lucky to get £32. Well, James Beckingham left radio 4 years ago after a decade because he just couldn't afford to live. He's now earning more than double what he was, working as a train driver, and he's been telling me his story.
I was very lucky to get the opportunity to tech op down at Invicta FM in 2002, and then even luckier, a friend of mine who now works in radio in the States got me into Capital and Leicester Square, which was a boyhood dream. I couldn't believe it when I walked through those doors of Leicester Square, and got involved with the digital operation there, which was Capital Life, Holiday FM and Capital Disney, which grew to be a radio station I fell quite deeply in love with. Through that, I was producer, presenter, did sort of an everything guy, which I think a lot of people tend to be in small stations, but also did some presenting on Fox FM and Victor FM. Then GCAT came along, added Core and The Storm to the mix, and then everything I seemed to touch closed down. So all the digital radio stations that Capital and GCAT had set up began to get switched off. So I moved to EMAP, as it was, as a creative producer on their digital brands. Then moved back to GCAT just in time to see Global arrive, and then decided that it was probably about time to leave the industry. I wasn't making any money out of it. It wasn't making me happy anymore. And everything I felt I loved about radio just didn't feel like it existed. It was a hard decision, but from a money point of view, a really good one to make, because I was in a lot of debt, and it was very difficult to make money. Still is difficult to make money in radio, but it was time to move on in 2011.
Through the 2000s then, what kind of shift rates were you getting for presenting work?
It varied, really. On an FM radio station, Fox FM, I was on £50 a shift. That would sometimes just about cover the coach fare from South London up to Oxford and back. If I was doing two shifts on the bounce, I'd stay in a travel lodge, and then I'd probably be doing it for the love then. If I made a fiver or a tenner out of it, I'd be lucky. But ultimately, the money would evaporate very quickly, and it would just be radio for the sake of being on air. just doing it for the love.
I suppose it's balancing that, doing it for the love and needing to pay all the bills, though, isn't it? And that's what led you to make the decision in the end to leave.
Yeah, it was a real balance there. And I was lucky through the early part of my career to be studying at university as well. So sort of student loans and cheap student life got me through, and then overdrafts and things. And by the end of my career, I just realised that all these overdrafts and credit cards and things I'd built up, it was unsustainable in radio. I couldn't continue to live that life anymore. It was time to pay the bills. And I hate to use the term grow up. Not grow up, but find a job that was going to enable me to have a life, have a better life.
And you found that, have you?
I have, yeah. I work in railway now. When I left Global in 2011, I went to work for TfL. Joined their London Overground division as a station manager. I've moved now to be a train driver for the much lamented Southern Railway, who everyone seems to hate. But I'm still able to use my skills, my presenting skills, when making announcements on the train and things like that. And Southern seem to like that. The passengers seem to like that. And I get quite a kick out of it as well, because I can bring a little bit of radio to weary commuters on their way home from London Bridge, which is quite nice.
There must be something about radio and train driving, because I think I know about five people who've left radio and gone and been train drivers. Is it the anorak value? Is that what it is?
There are a few of us out there. Yeah, it must be the anorak thing, mustn't it?
If money was better, would you go back to radio now?
Money is a lot better now. If it hadn't been for sort of walking away from... When I left Global, I was... got no problems at saying figures. I was on £21,000 a year, which was completely very difficult to sustain a life where I was living in a place called Penge in South London, which is actually one of the cheapest places to live in London, but one of the nicest as well, I must add. I mean, everyone knows what train drivers earn. We earn around about £45,000-£50,000 a year. Life is so much more comfortable now. I've been able to pay off all those debts I've accumulated in radio. The shift works hard, and sometimes the lack of creativity is really difficult to deal with. But you know what? It's nice to be able to afford things, which I never could when I was working for Capital, GCAP and Global.
It's really interesting that you said everybody knows what train drivers earn. At the BBC, there are pay scales in civil service and places. There are pay scales, and you will earn between this and that.
Yeah.
And it's the same for train drivers. So would it help for commercial radio to be like that, so that it was all a bit more open, rather than the boss is getting away with as little as he can pay you as possible?
Definitely. Do you know the thing that really concerns me about radio these days? I'll admit I have gone back to Media UK and Radio Today and had a look at the jobs pages and thought, oh, maybe, what if? But they never, ever put the salary on there. And that can only be a bad thing, because we all know what the starting salaries are. They're poor, and they generally tend to remain poor because it just doesn't feel like there's any money in commercial radio anymore.
That was James Beckingham speaking to the Radio Today programme, and the debate continues. Head to our Facebook page, facebook.com/radiotoday, and you can also check out Radio's workforce report in full at radiotoday.co.uk.
Thank you, Stuart. Fascinating stuff. David Lloyd's Radio Moments, after this word from our sponsors who are still on the road.
Well, thank you, Trevor, and welcome back to the Bionic Van. We've done about 1,300 miles since we spoke to you in Cambridgeshire. We've seen people in East Anglia, Yorkshire, as far north as Aberdeen. We've had public events in Glasgow, Newcastle, and today in sunny Manchester, and I can guarantee you it is actually sunny. Oasis, which is the social media part of Phonebox, has really opened people's eyes to what's possible now in a radio studio. Not just about the messages being sent into you, but finding show content that's not necessarily been sent to you or the radio station. Something else which people love is Music Master. People have been using the same software to schedule songs for years. Now it's just a bit of a security blanket. But with Music Master, you can integrate on an API level with most playout systems. So you can reconcile your log as you're going through, also share song data between the two systems. Also, you can integrate with social media, with YouTube, and online resources like Radio Monitor to get airplay data, and I Love Music to get your metadata straight into the scheduler. The other thing that people have been a bit jealous of are our Omnium processors that we've got on board. I had a bunch of engineers and PDs yesterday at a radio station trying to steal our Omnium 9. They really know now why it would help them keep their listeners listening. If anyone else wants to find out why before they get the upper hand on you, we're in Cardiff on Wednesday, And we've got a London event as well on the 4th of June. So please do come and see the Bionic Van. Email us, bionicvan@bionics.co.uk for more details and to book your place at one of the events. That's bionicvan@bionics.co.uk.
Radio Moments. We start this week with another Commercial Radio 40th anniversary, and it's Hello Plymouth for a truly classic launch.
Now, we've got a lot of excitement here this morning because I understand that waiting to speak to us is the first child that's been born around about the same time that we are. So I hope I push the right buttons, and I will say hello to Sister Golding. Hello, Sister Golding. Can you hear us? Hello, Sister Golding? Now, just one moment. Hello, Sister Golding? Hello? Hello? Oh, dear, oh, dear. Well, never mind. These things are...
The launch of Plymouth Sound this week in 75. It's now Heart. And that first hour didn't get any easier. Here's the second link.
Louise, are we in business?
Yes, we are indeed, Colin.
Oh, my goodness me, it works.
I think the baby's right here.
No, I have to push this particular button.
Yes. Go on.
I push that. No. We're going to have it over the air, dear. Hello? 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 Hello?
Hello. Meanwhile, that same week 40 years ago, an exciting new competition on commercial radio in Newcastle.
Don't say hello, say Metro, our cash accumulator competition in which we pick a number at random from the Metropolitan Area Telephone Directory.
Don't say hello, say...
Metro.
Well done, who am I speaking to?
Mr. Farmer, 25 Fiat Terrace, Stone.
Hi, welcome along to Metro Radio. You now have possibly the chance to win yourself £49 if you can get two questions right. The first question is for a record or record token.
The jackpot rose £1 a day, and this week in 75, the first big winner won £88. 1924 now, and this week that year, something special from the BBC, one of the first proper outside broadcasts. Beatrice Harrison played Delius's cello concerto, accompanied by nightingales, in her Surrey garden.
But the next day, our dear old gardener came along in great excitement. Oh, he said, the nightingales come back again. I believe it's the cello. And... it struck me how lovely it would be if he could be broadcast.
And that annual broadcast continued for 12 years. This week sees the 50th anniversary of the death of the person named as the first British disc jockey. He was Christopher Stone.
And so, there it was. I was working very hard, and I suddenly came to the conclusion that the BBC were not having really the best new records that were coming out into my office.
You know the Decca signature, D-E-C-C-A, and you know the Decca catalogue. Now, out of the catalogue, let's make the Decca alphabet. Beginning with A for Al, it was Al all the way, Al Bowley.
Christopher Stone, there with Brandon DeGratian later in his career at Radio Luxembourg. Happy birthday this week to one of his many successors.
ILR was just about to open. I'm going back to now 1973-74, and there was nowhere for a disc jockey to get experience apart from the clubs, and the word disco in radio is often sort of looked down upon. I mean, I think discos are marvellous, but to get to the first step is always the most difficult one, and that was United Biscuits. It was like doing rep in the theatre, 24 hours a day.
Sunday mornings were made for music, so let Tony have your requests, but please write in at least 10 days in advance, and then tune in again this weekend.
Dale Winton, who's 60 this week. We can't do This Week in History without this one from 1937. It's what the press now call a gaffe. The BBC at the time said it was just him overworking a little.
This colossal fleet... lit up by lights. And the whole thing isn't fairyland. It isn't true. It isn't here. And as I say it, it's gone. It's gone. There's no fleet. It's disappeared.
The earliest radio fail of all, the BBC commentary on the naval fleet illumination with a very happy Lieutenant Commander Thomas Woodruff this week, 78 years ago. This week in 1992, the RAB was formed, the Radio Advertising Bureau, a voice for the commercial radio industry.
Editorial-linked, paid-for communication. And I call it that because it's across all media now. But the stuff where it really makes its money, and more importantly, the stuff where it really interests the advertiser, is when you do ads, spots, and you link it in with some other audience engagement thing.
Douglas MacArthur. So with Star FM launching in Slough 22 years ago...
I'm Peter Dixon.
...the chairman of Leicester's Centre Radio walking out 33 years ago... Marjorie Anderson leaving Woman's Hour after 15 years, 42 years ago...
From time to time in Woman's Hour, we've heard women who took an active part in the suffragette movement...
...and the Yorkshire Radio Network launching 28 years ago...
Culmination of Radio Hallam in Sheffield, Pennine Radio in Bradford and Viking Radio in Hull.
Those are this week's Radio Moments.
Radio Moments!
Thank you, David, Stuart. Thanks to all our contributors this week. If you want to find out more about IPE and what they do, visit ipe-systems.com. This has been a production by TDC, also one of the finalists in the New York Awards this week, we're pleased to say. More next week. Thanks for listening.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics.